This is the sixth day of this July 2009 seven-day session. Today we're going to switch course and read some material, some autobiographical material by Zen Master Hakuin. It's a little window into the process of coming up with Teisho. This morning I noticed a slight resistance in myself to doing another day from the material, the miscellaneous teachings that we've been doing in the Sesshin. And you learn that if you're not 100% behind some material for Teisho, it's not the best thing to do, because the teacher has to feel inspired, excited about material in order for there to be a chance that the students will be inspired by it. So then I considered doing a koan, but same slight resistance. And then I thought of this chant that we always do before Teisho, Master Hakuin's chant in praise of Zazen, and his own remarkable life and practice, which I used to read from more, as did Roshi Kaplow. But I came to feel that it doesn't lend itself so well to commentary in Teisho. Most of the material we have on Hakuin consists of letters, very long letters. It might take 2 or 3 days to read from. And they just aren't that suited to presenting one's own reflections, thoughts, comments on the material. So what I'm going to do today is read his own words, his story. It's a very different style, completely different style than what we've been reading. I'll let it speak for itself. This is from a book called The Zen Master Hakuin, translated by Philip Yampolsky. This is one of only 3 or 4 texts that were available in English, Zen texts that were available in English in the 1970s. And Roshi Kaplow had pretty much had to just rotate through this and a book about Dogen, or a book of his teachings, and one or two others. But there's such a wide selection now of Zen texts to choose from, and this one I haven't done in quite a while. He begins when he was a boy. When I was 7 or 8 years old, my mother took me to a temple for the first time, and we listened to a sermon on the hells as described in the Moho Chi Kwan. So this would be, Hakuin grew up in a small town. Oh, by the way, he lived in the late 1600s. And in 1700s, so he died just before the American Revolutionary War. At that time in China, a small town in Japan, it would not be uncommon for the form of Buddhism that was preached would be the kind of popular Buddhism that I alluded to earlier in this session, where the hells, the the threat of the Buddhist hells would be emphasized, and that's just what he heard. The priest dwelt eloquently on the torments of the hells of wailing. These are different hells. Hells of wailing, searing heat, incessant suffering, and the red lotus. That sounds ominous. it says here in footnote, where the victims have sores on their bodies, the color of this blossom. This is the seventh of the eight cold hells, in case, just for the record. So vivid was the priest's description that it sent shivers down the spines of both monks and laymen and made their hair stand on end in terror. Returning home, I took stock of the deeds of my short life. Hey, some of us have been there. I took stock of the deeds of my short life and felt that there was but little hope for me. I did not know which way to turn, and I was goose flesh all over. In secret, I took up the chapter on Kanon from the Lotus Sutra and the Dharani on Great Compassion and recited them day and night. This Dharani on Great Compassion is the Daishin Dharani that we chant, the longer of the two Dharanis. So we see here a kid who was already very disposed to the religious life and with a very sensitive conscience. One day when I was taking a bath with my mother, she asked that the water be made hotter and had the maid add wood to the fire. Gradually my skin began to prickle with the heat, and the iron bath cauldron began to rumble. Suddenly I recalled the descriptions of the hells that I had heard, and I let out a cry of terror that resounded through the neighborhood. From this time on, I determined to myself that I would leave home to become a monk. To this, my parents would not consent. Yet I went constantly to the temple to recite the sutras and to study the works of Confucianism. At 15, I left home to become a monk, and at that time I vowed to myself, even if I should die, I will not cease my efforts to gain the power of one whom fire will not burn and water will not drown. This is a phrase that was used in Zen to, of course, indicate one who has attained the transcendent. Day and night I recited the sutras and made obeisance to the Buddhas, but I noticed that when I was ill or taking acupuncture or moxa treatment, the pain I felt was just as it had been before. I was greatly depressed. Let me just pause there. There are those who have said that in this day and age, Hakuin could possibly be diagnosed as bipolar personality. And from what I know of that disorder, I think it is quite possible. Wildly emotional guy with swings and ups and downs. I was greatly depressed and said to myself, I became a monk against my parents' wishes and have yet to make the slightest progress. I have heard that the lotus is the king of all sutras, venerated even by ghosts and spirits. People who are suffering in the lower worlds, when they rely on others in their efforts to be saved, always ask that the Lotus Sutra be recited for them. When one considers that recitation by others can save a person from suffering, how much more effective must be recitation by oneself? There must indeed be profound and mysterious doctrines in this Lotus Sutra. Thereupon, I picked up the Lotus Sutra and in my study of it found that, other than the passages that explain that there is only one vehicle and that all phenomena are in the state of nirvana, the text was concerned with parables relating to cause and effect. If this sutra had all these virtues, then surely the six Confucian classics and the books of all the other schools must be equally effective. Why should this particular sutra be so highly esteemed? My hopes were completely dashed. At this time, I was 16 years of age. So, to comment on this for a minute. So what he runs across are these stories, and stories about the workings of causation, karma. And he's perspicacious enough religiously to recognize that this is just a conventional form of spiritual understanding, that doing good results in good consequences, and doing bad results in bad consequences. And so he didn't see what really would distinguish the Lotus Sutra from these other highly venerated texts of the Confucian classics. It wasn't enough for him, in other words. Now, there's a whole Buddhist school that's based on the Lotus Sutra, and it is unquestionably a marvelous sutra, and one of the most esteemed in the Zen school, the Lotus Sutra. But it didn't do it for him. When I was 19, I happened to read the title doesn't matter, it's in Chinese. It's a collection of biographies of famous monks. I happened to read that, and in it, the story of how the master Yen Tao, and the Japanese name is Ganto, who some of you will remember from koans I've commented on in Teisho, the story of how the master Yen Tao was killed by bandits and how his cries at the time resounded for over 3 li is described. I think a li is, it's a mile or two or half a mile or something. It doesn't matter. It was a long way that those cries were heard. I wondered why such an enlightened monk was unable to escape the swords of thieves. If such a thing could happen to a man who was like a unicorn or phoenix among monks, a dragon in the sea of Buddhism, how was I to escape the staves of the demons of hell after I died? What use was there in studying Zen? What a fraud, Buddhism! How I regretted that I had cast myself into this band of strange and evil men. What was I to do now? So great was my distress that for 3 days I could not eat, and for a long time my faith in Buddhism was completely lost. Statues of the Buddha and the sacred sutras looked like mud and dirt to me. It seemed much better to read lay works, to amuse myself with poetry and prose, and thus to a small degree to alleviate my distress. All right, he's in a crisis now. The age of 19, seized with doubts about this path. And look at what triggered this. Hearing about this great, great Zen master, deeply enlightened master, who, when he was run through with a sword by these bandits, let out this great cry that echoed through the hills. There are plenty of people, especially beginners, who imagine that once you're enlightened, you become impervious to pain, that you are somehow delivered from the ordinary responses that would come from, or, for example, being startled. Walking down a dark street and someone jumps out and shrieks at you, that somehow after enlightenment you're like a stone. You don't have ordinary human responses. It's silly nonsense. It's a romantic, childish view of enlightenment. As long as we have bodies, we've got hormones, we've got an endocrine system that is wired to respond in certain ways. And it is at least to the extremes of circumstances. Naturally, the longer you do Zazen, the more the body-mind will settle, and the more we get free of just anxiety based on thoughts about self and other. Yes. But this incident of Ganto's great cry is a famous one in Zen, and one that can be understood entirely differently after awakening. But the young Hakuin was not yet awakened. As those of you who know about Hakuin know, he was a gifted painter, writer, poet, and so he reasoned that he could get by in his life with his artistic pursuits. But lucky for us, he didn't. When I was 22, I went to the province of Wakasa, and while attending lectures, doesn't matter, certain lectures, I gained an awakening. Later, when I was in the province of Iyo, I read the... I'm scanning footnotes here. Doesn't matter. I read something and achieved an intense awakening. I concentrated night and day on the Mu Koan without a moment's rest. But to my great disappointment, I was unable to achieve a pure and uninvolved state of undistracted meditation. Equally disappointing to me was the fact that I could not achieve the state where waking and sleeping are the same. So what he describes as first an awakening and then an intense awakening, he would probably later not think of it that way because he was still working on Mu. The spring of my 24th year found me in the monks' quarters of the Eiganji, pursuing my strenuous studies. Night and day I did not sleep. I forgot both to eat and rest. Suddenly a great doubt manifested itself before me. Doubt here now means questioning, perplexity. This is the Zen doubt. Not skepticism. It was as though I were frozen solid in the midst of an ice sheet extending tens of thousands of miles. A purity filled my breast, and I could neither go forward nor retreat. To all intents and purposes, I was out of my mind, and the Mu alone remained. He's describing here a deep samadhi. Although I sat in the lecture hall and listened to the master's lecture, it was as though I were hearing a discussion from a distance outside the hall. At times it felt as though I were floating through the air. This state lasted for several days. He was remarkably deep into his practice. Then I chanced to hear the sound of the temple bell, and I was suddenly transformed. It was as if a sheet of ice had been smashed, or a jade tower had fallen with a crash. Suddenly I returned to my senses. I felt then that I had achieved the status of Yentao, who through the three periods of time encountered not the slightest loss, although he had been murdered by bandits. Three periods of time, past, present, and future. That although he'd been murdered and let out this great cry, he was undiminished by this. Now he understood Yentao's murder. All my former doubts vanished as though ice had melted away. In a loud voice I called, "Wonderful, wonderful! There is no cycle of birth and death through which one must pass. There is no enlightenment one must seek. The 1700 koans handed down from the past have not the slightest value whatsoever." My pride soared up like a majestic mountain. My arrogance surged forward like the tide. Smugly I thought to myself, in the past 200 or 300 years, no one could have accomplished such a marvelous breakthrough as this. This, too, is not an uncommon first response to a deep awakening. It sounds so paradoxical. How, when if you've genuinely seen through the self, how could there be this pride? But it's what I was talking about earlier in Sesshin, that there's the insight, but then there are the habit forces, the lag, the conditioning, which take longer to purify. The example, the simile that is sometimes given, is like they say a chicken, when its head is cut off, will continue skittering around the ground for a few seconds or longer before it topples over dead, which also makes no sense, except that there's this kind of reflex, or this momentum, energetic momentum that carries on for a little while, even after the head has been severed or one has seen through the self to a degree. Shouldering my glorious enlightenment, I set out at once for Shinano. Calling on Master Shouju, I told him of my experience and presented him with a verse. The master, holding my verse up in his left hand, said to me, "This verse is what you have learned from study. Now show me what your intuition has to say." And he held out his right hand. I replied, "If there were something intuitive that I could show you, I'd vomit it out." And I made a gagging sound. The master said, "How do you understand Zhao Zhou's Mu?" I replied, "What sort of place does Mu have that one can attach arms and legs to it?" The master twisted my nose with his fingers and said, "Here's some place to attach arms and legs." I was stunned, and the master gave a hearty laugh. "You poor, hole-dwelling devil," he cried. I paid him no attention, and he continued, "Do you think somehow that you have sufficient understanding?" Now let's pause here. When do we ever have sufficient understanding? Who has ever had sufficient understanding? Hakuin later, in his advanced years, was known for these two sayings. Buddhism is like the sea. The further you go into it, the deeper it gets. Oh, it's like a mountain. The higher you climb, the more you can see. If mind, this Buddha mind is boundless, unlimited, unfathomable, then how can our understanding of it be limited, bounded, fathomed? We can always go deeper, further. In this book or in some other book by Hakuin, he says that he had 18 major enlightenments and countless smaller ones. Even with his tendency to exaggerate, we'll see as we read on here that he just went on and on and on. When I was at a Rinzai temple training in Japan, I noticed that there was a little stand in the zendo where the bell, the inking bell, sat. At this temple, Sogenji, the duties of monitor and timer are the same person. Same person does it. And next to his mat is this small wooden stand where the inking bell sat. And on it was a character, a Japanese character. And I asked what the character meant and was told that it means not yet. Not yet. Even Shakyamuni is only halfway there. And here, this whippersnapper, Hakuin, felt that he had achieved some crowning level of insight. It's a disease. It's the worst kind of disease. And this master Shoju, of course, knew that he had to shake Hakuin out of his pride and complacency. Now Hakuin had the resources now to turn, and he said, "What do you think is missing?" Then the master began to discuss the koan that tells of Nanxuan's death. I clapped my hands over my ears and started out of the room. I could hear him saying, "La la 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 la." The master called after me, "Hey, monk!" And when I turned to him, he said, "You poor hole-dwelling devil." From then on, almost every time he saw me, the master called me a poor hole-dwelling devil. Noticed. Appreciate the caliber of Hakuin's, his aspiration, that he stayed with this, all this abuse he gets from the master. he recognizes, some part of him recognizes that he has a lot more to see. And he has the humility, the character to just bow, and the faith in the Master. One evening, the Master sat cooling himself on the veranda. Again, I brought him a verse I had written. The Master read it and said, "Delusions and fancies." I shouted his words back at him in a loud voice. It's so childish. You know.
Yeah, delusions and fantasies.
Whereupon, the Master seized me and rained 20 or 30 blows with his fists on me and then pushed me off the veranda. This was on the fourth day of the fifth month after a long spell of rain. So in the spring, after a long spell of rain, I lay stretched out in the mud as though dead, scarcely breathing and almost unconscious. I could not move. Meanwhile, the Master sat on the veranda roaring with laughter. He knew that he had someone of extraordinarily strong spirit he was working with here. And resilience, same thing, same thing. After a short while, I regained consciousness, got up, and bowed to the Master. My body was bathed in perspiration. The Master called out to me in a loud voice, "You poor hole-dwelling devil." After this, I devoted myself to an intensive study of the koan on the death of Nanchuan, not pausing to sleep or eat. One day, I had a kind of awakening and went to the Master's room to test my understanding, but he would not approve it. All he did was call me, altogether now, a poor hole-dwelling devil. Let me just pause and mention, you know, Hakuin, for those of you who don't know, he's considered one of the two great lights in Japanese Zen, along with Dogen. His Zazen Wasan, this chant and praise of Zazen that we do, could be one of the two or three most succinct, most powerful documents about the understanding of the Zen sect of Buddhism. He's credited with having almost single-handedly restored the vigor of the Rinzai school in Japan. His predecessor, who was credited with doing that in China, was Da Wei. But already, by the time it reached Hakuin, Zen had declined. And Hakuin, with this titanic spirit and energy and creativity of his, turned it around, restored the integrity and the spirit of the whole koan system that the Rinzai school is based on. There are these two primary schools in Japan of Zen, the Soto and the Rinzai. The Soto, the emphasis is on our fundamental enlightenment that is beyond attaining or not attaining. It's our nature. It's our nature. In the Rinzai school, of course, that would be accepted. It's just what enlightenment reveals is from the very beginning all beings are Buddha. But in the Rinzai school, they insist that you can't be talking or thinking like that until you have confirmed it through an awakening experience. And so there's this emphasis in the Rinzai school on realization that you don't find in the Soto school. In the Soto school, realization, enlightenment, awakening, these are almost dirty words. Because their position is, oh, as soon as you speak of enlightenment, then you're dividing the indivisible. You're falling into dualism. Just be one with your daily life. Yeah, great, be one with your daily life. But you know what helps that more than anything? Having an awakening experience. I began to think that I had better leave and go somewhere else. One day when I had gone to town to beg for food, this was either Takahatsu as we know it, or the ritual making the rounds, the monks would make the rounds for donations of food, or it was some precursor to that that he was doing on his own. When I had gone to town to beg for food, I encountered a madman who tried to beat me with a broom. Unexpectedly, I found that I had penetrated the koan on the death of Nan Chuan. Then the other koans that had puzzled me, Su Shan's memorial tower and Da Wei's verse on the roundness of the lotus leaf, fell into place of themselves, and I penetrated them all. After I returned to the temple, I spoke of the understanding I had gained. The master neither approved nor denied what I said, but only laughed pleasantly. But from this time on, he stopped calling me a poor hole-dwelling devil. Later, I experienced enlightenment two or three times, accompanied by a great feeling of joy. At times, there are words to express such experiences, but to my regret, at other times, there are none. It was as though I were walking about in the shadow cast by a lantern. I returned then and attended on my old teacher, Nyoka, who had fallen ill. One day I read in the verse, well, let's just skip the particulars. One day I read the passage, as we go to part, a tall bamboo stands by the gate. Its leaves stir the clear breeze for you in farewell. I was overcome with a great joy, as though a dark path had suddenly been illumined. Unconsciously, I cried aloud, today, for the first time, I have entered into the samadhi of words. I arose and bowed in reverence. After this, I set out on pilgrimage. One day, when I was passing through southern Ise, I ran into a downpour and the water reached to my knees. Suddenly, I gained an even deeper understanding of the verse on the roundness of the lotus leaf by Da Wei. I was unable to contain my joy. I lost all awareness of my body, fell headlong into the waters, and forgot completely to get up again. My bundles and clothing were soaked through. Fortunately, a passerby, seeing my predicament, helped me to get up. I roared with laughter, and everyone there thought I was mad. That winter, when I was sitting at night in the monk's hall at Shinoda, I gained an enlightenment from the sound of snow falling. The next year, while practicing walking meditation at the monk's hall, I suddenly had an enlightenment experience greater than any I had had before and was overcome by a great surge of joy. I came to this dilapidated temple when I was 32. One night in a dream, my mother came and presented me with a purple robe made of silk. When I lifted it, both sleeves seemed very heavy, and on examining them, I found an old mirror, 5 or 6 inches in diameter, in each sleeve. The reflection from the mirror in the right sleeve penetrated to my heart and vital organs. My own mind, mountains and rivers, the great earth, seemed serene and bottomless. The mirror in the left sleeve, however, gave off no reflection whatsoever. Its surface was like that of a new pan that had yet to be touched by flames. But suddenly I became aware that the luster of the mirror from the left sleeve was innumerable times brighter than the other. After this, when I looked at all things, it was as though I were seeing my own face. For the first time, I understood the meaning of the saying, "The Tathagata sees the Buddha nature within his eye." Later, I happened to read the Blue Cliff record, and my understanding of it differed completely from what it had been before. One night, sometime after, I took up the Lotus Sutra. Suddenly, I penetrated to the perfect, true, ultimate meaning of the sutra, of the lotus. The doubts I had held initially were destroyed, and I became aware that the understanding I had obtained up to then was greatly in error. Unconsciously, I uttered a great cry and burst into tears. I wish that everyone would realize that practicing Zen under a teacher is not such a simple matter after all. Although I am old and dissipated and have nothing of which I can be proud, I am aware that at least I have not spent 40 years in vain. Was it not for this reason that Chang Wu, when he was in Yangzhou, let go of his gold and engaged in his painful struggles toward success? Must be Layman Pong. As in the example I gave you, if you shoulder the one-sided understanding you have gained and spend your whole life vainly polishing and purifying it, how are you any different from Chang Lu, who guarded his piece of gold throughout his life, starving himself and bringing only harm to his body? And then he ends with something that is a little more off topic. It's not his own story, and we don't need to read it. Hakuin is just one of many masters who, after an initial experience, recognized the unlimited nature of mind and the unlimited capacity to realize this mind. There are other great masters who, after the initial surge of joy and sometimes pride, just buckled down and went back to work to go deeper, deeper, beyond, beyond, gatte, gatte, paragatte. Wherever any one of us is, wherever we are in our practice, we're not there yet. stop now and recite the four vows.